Thank you, Dr. Brook. The next paper is being presented by Dr. Catherine Hoffman. Dr. Hoffman is a consultant here at Warm Springs, and her paper is on the implications of activity and exercise lifestyle patterns in relation to fatigue factors. Dr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Dr. Halstead. Is this at the right angle? Can you hear me? Okay. I have no audiovisual material to use today, so you will have to be patient and simply listen to the material. Certainly, we'll be happy to answer your questions. We've had over 100 patients seen here in the polio clinics at Warm Springs during the past 7 months. 60 of these patients were questioned. Okay. In detail, concerning their specific activity and exercise lifestyles. It's my intent at this time to present this type of information as a useful information system to supplement the classic history taken by healthcare professionals in relation to the complaints registered by post-polio patients. 91 aspects of the patient's activity and exercise lifestyle have been taken into account. It should be noted by all here that we have made no correlations at this time with defective body mechanics, deformities present, degree and patterns of muscle weakness, or other existing medical problems, although it is acknowledged that these facts combined with the activity and exercise patterns of these patients are significant contributors to their complaints. Of the 60 patients reviewed in this manner, there were 37 females, 23 males. Their ages range between 33 to 73 years. Chief complaints included pain. This was either generalized pain, one specific location, or more than one specific location. Weakness. This was generalized weakness, one specific location of weakness, or more than one specific location of weakness. Fatigue, headaches, edema, breathing problems, urinary tract problems, and voice weakness. 5 of the 60 patients had no complaints. Their purposes for attending the clinic was simply for a checkup for baseline purposes or to have brace work done. Their domestic arrangements revealed that 10 of the patients live alone, 12 live with family but are usually alone, and 38 live with family or friend and are not usually alone. The time of arising in the morning ranged from 4 a.m. to 10 a.m. The time of retiring for the evening ranged from 7:30 p.m. until 2 a.m. The total uptime of these individuals ranged from 12 hours to 21 hours. 41 of the patients had a total uptime of 15 to 17 hours. 8 of the patients had a total uptime of 17 to 18 hours. 1 of 19 hours, and 1 of 21 hours. Interestingly enough, the patient with a 21-hour uptime was a manic depressive personality disorder, and her chief complaint was fatigue. 5 of the 60 patients said that they took a rest period, only 5, which I thought was interesting. 4 of these were 30-minute rest periods. 1 was a 90-minute rest period. A review of the eating habits, and this might be of interest to Dr. Maynard, reveals that 46 of the people ate breakfast, 55 ate dinner, 60 ate supper. I have not calculated the total caloric intake of these individuals. However, it appears to be low in the majority of the patients. It appears that the general eating trends are for minimal calories to be ingested during the day and the majority of the calories to be ingested in the evening. Household activities were reviewed, a total of 17 different household activities. The most frequent housework patterns were dusting, picking up objects from the floor, making beds, changing beds, bending to low surfaces, washing dishes, vacuuming, sweeping with a broom, and doing the laundry. I had intended to attach MET equivalents to those particular activities. However, I thought that that might spark a great deal of controversy in this audience, and I decided not to do that at this time. There were 9 items reviewed in relation to outside work. The most frequent of these was yard work, including raking the yard, cutting the grass. Interestingly, 7 of the patients cut grass with a manual push mower. 6 used a push power mower, and 4 used a riding mower. Chopping wood, carrying wood, shoveling and digging, and pushing a wheelbarrow. 41 of the patients did their own grocery shopping. They drove their own cars to do their grocery shopping. 33 of these pushed the cart, and 23 carried bags, the grocery bags. They described their living quarters as 1-story in 38 of the patients, 2 stories in 18 of the patients, and 14 of the patients also had a basement. The number of outside steps varied from 0 to 40, inside steps 0 to 26. 4 people had ramps, and 1 person had an elevator. In the category of work, the occupational status of these individuals revealed that 44 of the 60 people are employed. 39 of these say that they're employed full-time, 4 say that they're employed part-time only, 7 are working 2 jobs, 5 are unemployed, 7 are retired, and in the disability status, one was considering disability, 3 were on disability, and 3 were applying for disability, which I thought was an interesting number out of the total of 60, which was very minimal. The total working time per week ranged from 15 hours to over 60 hours. 22 of these 41 patients worked between 40 and over 60-hour work week. The occupations that the patients listed revealed that 42 of them were in managerial, supervisory, or professional positions. 2 of them were salespeople. Thus, it is evident that they have chosen their occupations well to adapt either to their impairment patterns or at least to their energy levels. The transportation patterns were that 42 of them drove themselves to work and 2 used other means of transportation. Distance traveled to work under 1 mile, only 2, 1 to 10 miles, 33 of the 41 patients, and 6 between 10 to 25 miles, over 100 miles was 3 of the patients. Steps to the main entrance range from 0 to 40 steps. 5 people had a ramp in their working area, entering the working area. In looking at the type of work in relation to the position and the categories in the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, sedentary occupations were 39 patients. Standing positions, 18 said that there was some standing, 3 said that their jobs involved all standing. Walking, 26 said that there was some walking, 2 said that it was all walking. 5 said that they had carrying involved in their jobs. One of these involved 50 pounds carrying, the remainder was 5 pounds. Lifting in 6 patients, again one of those was 50 pounds, the remainder were 5 pounds. I did a review of environmental factors. This included temperature, pollutants, and irritants, as well as humidity in the workplace. Most of these people answered that these were normal temperature and humidity, and pollutants and irritants were not present. The ones that answered that pollutants were present included dust, chemical fumes, offset ink, carbon dust, and aerosols. They indicated that there was stress on the job. 3 of them said there was no stress on their jobs. 8 said there was mild stress. 22 said moderate. And 11, severe. The breaks that they were taking were between 15 to 30 minutes. 20 took no breaks. 1 took 1 break. 9 took 2 breaks. And 4 took 3 breaks. 40 of them did take a lunch hour. And 3 did not take a lunch hour. I am running out of time, and so I'll go over here to exercise patterns in their lifestyles. In reviewing exercise patterns specifically, 14 of them said they swim laps, 2 walk laps, 4 do stationary bicycles, 3 do weightlifting, 3 play golf, 1 does boating and canoeing, 1 nautilus, 1 cybex, 2 water exercises. Other exercises or activity patterns included one patient pushing his wheelchair up and down a driveway repetitively on an incline to condition his upper extremities. Interestingly enough, his chief complaint was neck pain and shoulder pain and fatigue. He has markedly restricted pulmonary function also. One did weaving for 3 hours a day. One did fast walking on a mini trampoline for 1 hour a day. This particular individual also did bicycle ergometry for 45 minutes at a high resistance on the same day. Her chief complaint was fatigue so severe that she was working part-time. Another one did hiking, one coached t-ball, one danced regularly, and one did walking stairs repetitively for exercise at the suggestion of her physician. Her complaint was leg pain and fatigue. I have 1 minute left, so in summary, I have not told you all the information that I have here, but 91 aspects of activity and exercise lifestyles have been reviewed on 60 post-polio patients. 5 of the 60 patients had no complaints. The remaining 55 patients complained of pain, weakness, fatigue, edema, breathing problems, urinary tract problems, and voice weakness. It is suggested that the addition of a complete review of the factors discussed to the classic history taken by healthcare professionals on post-polio patients is a valuable adjunct in determining specific factors causing or contributing to their complaints. It is noted once again that no correlations are being made at this time with other clinical features such as defective body mechanics, deformities present, degree and patterns of muscle weakness, or other existing medical problems, although it is acknowledged that these factors combined with these lifestyle patterns are significant contributors to their complaints. Questions?
This is Hyman Fisher from Rancho. I was wondering if you got any detailed sleep histories on these people.
No, I didn't.
Because that's subject I'll be talking about.
Fugelmeier of Northern Sweden. Thank you for a good and beautifully told story. I loved it. However, I wonder, did you look upon life satisfaction anyway? Do you have any idea if these people are reasonably satisfied with life? I'm not talking about controlled epidemiological studies and things like that. You have carefully avoided that, and I enjoyed that. Or have you any idea if they have recently experienced any changes in the quality of their life or the satisfaction with their life?
I'm not really clear about what you mean by satisfaction. Are you meaning emotional enjoyment, emotional satisfaction, relaxation? What's your definition of satisfaction?
Well, I'm talking about, could we say, global or general life satisfaction and or domain-specific satisfaction derived from different activities.
I did not question them concerning satisfaction derived from various activities simply because I was looking very specifically at their complaints and patterns of muscle weakness as a physiatrist. I have difficulty answering questions about global satisfaction because I find that a broad concept, and I have difficulty speaking in broad concepts when we're talking about individual patients.
Jacqueline Perry from Rancho. Because of your shortness of time, you sort of had to go the exercise rather fast. In your general impression of the 60 patients, how many do you think were inappropriately using exercise and contributing to their symptoms?
Let me take a quick look at these that I've listed, and as I can recall the specific patients, I can probably give you a rough idea. Are you asking that in relation to the possibility of overwork, weakness of muscle, or tendon problems, or both? Is this overwork?
I'm asking in reference to their enthusiasm for exercise is contributing to their symptoms.
Okay. I would say that both of the people doing the walking were, in my opinion, increasing their symptoms by their walking pattern. Two of the people on the stationary bicycle were increasing their symptoms by the stationary bicycle. I think all three of the people doing weightlifting were causing their symptoms by their weightlifting. The people playing golf in this particular group, I thought that that was not contributing to any of their problems. However, there was one other person who was a golfer who did not answer these questions, who had very specific muscle weakness in one shoulder girdle that I thought was specifically related to that. The Nautilus, indeed, this patient reported that after a two-month program on the Nautilus, he stopped himself because he had significant weakness and was quite a lot less functional. Certainly, the person pushing the wheelchair up and down the driveway on an incline repetitively was having rather severe problems in areas that could be correlated well with that activity. The May trampoline and the stationary bicycle combination, I thought, were significant contributors to that patient's complaints of severe fatigue. Although I have to add there that I think that she has other medical problems that are additional contributors, and I think that that is possibly the value of this type of information, so that you can get a total outlook on the aspects contributing to these complaints. And the other one, walking stairs repetitively for exercise, I thought was a definite contributor to the complaints.
Peter Gow, New Zealand. Fatigue is dependent in part on fuel supply versus energy expenditure. You mentioned briefly METs, and I'm just wondering whether you estimate in any way the caloric intake versus the energy expenditure to see whether that related in any way to fatigue.
I had intended to do that, but I simply ran out of time.
Other questions? Do we have any remaining questions?
Bert Chubel, Northwestern. Did you have any patients in your group who you thought improved with exercise? And I know we're going to get into this more tomorrow, but I have seen a couple patients who were mildly weak who insisted to me that they were better with exercise. Now, I haven't followed those over a long period of time, and those two patients that I know were only mildly weak, not severely weak, but I wonder in your series if you had any patients like that.
In this particular information that I was presenting, as I mentioned, I did not make any, I really didn't even look at the muscle tests and the change in the muscle tests, or, and we have many that we have documented muscle tests for several years, so that I cannot make that comment in relation to casual exercise. If that's what you're talking, again, what is your concept? What concept of exercise are you referring to? Is it therapeutic prescribed exercise, or is it casual exercise?
No, well, these are patients who were mildly weak, who put themselves on a strengthening exercise program, and they this is what they related to me.
Well, see, I would certainly disagree with that concept, and I'm sure there's a lot of discussion about that, but. I have had patients that were on prescribed exercise programs by trained physical therapists who are familiar with the overwork concept, who did improve and regained function with that type of program. I don't agree with the concept that I have just presented in that people are doing their own types of exercise that I think are obviously overworking or causing symptoms in numbers of these people.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman. At the end of each of the sessions for the conference, we have asked selected individuals if they would take about 10 minutes to stand back and take a long perspective overview of what has been presented, as well as what has transcribed in the course of the discussions, and try as best they might to both summarize and to hit some of the highlights and maybe identify some of the pertinent issues that remain to be pursued. I realize that can sometimes be a difficult task, but ask Dr. Ted Munsat from Tufts if he might give it a crack for this first session. Dr. Munsat.
Summary statements are often left to the elder members of a scientific group, which doesn't sit well with me personally anyway. And so I asked Dr. Halstead if I might in fact present some experimental data for a few minutes of that 10-minute time, which addresses the question of, could I have the first slide, are people with post-polio complaints actually getting progressively weaker or not. But I won't go over my 10-minute allotment, Dr. Halstead. We use a procedure which we chauvinistically call the Tufts Quantitative Neuromuscular Exam, or TQNE. It consists of a number of quantifiable and reproducible testing items which have been designed specifically for neuromuscular diseases. The heart of this battery of tests is maximum voluntary isometric strength, which was recorded with a simple strain gauge and strip recorder, which we feel is presently the most valid and reproducible way of measuring the functioning motor unit. Next slide. I guess I can change it here. We've done a number of reliability studies, which I won't go into, but let me just say that the test is amazingly reproducible. We have a variance of about 6 to 8%, depending on the item. We're testing both intra and inter-rater reliability, both for patients with ALS, patients with post-polio, and for normals as well. So we feel quite confident that it is both a valid and a reliable testing procedure. Now, most of our work to date has been in ALS patients, and if you follow ALS patients longitudinally, as in this single patient, we're using here a composite or mega score for both arms. There is a remarkable linear deterioration with time, which corresponds, I believe, to the dropout of alpha motor neurons. And we've applied the same approach to a number of post-polio patients, and specifically we wanted to answer the question, is there a loss in muscle force, and if so, what is the pattern of this muscle loss with time? We have enrolled in our database all patients appearing in our clinic complaining of post-polio type complaints, and we've asked them to go through a complete TQNE 3 to 4 or even more times per year. And we now have 44 patients entered. The reason I didn't submit an abstract to this conference is I didn't think we really had enough numbers to make a statement. But when I went over the data last week, it seemed that indeed we've got a small number of patients, 6, who've had enough TQNEs over a long enough period of time to, in a very preliminary way and descriptive way, say what's happening to them. Now, what you'll see here is single muscle or limb functions plotted against time, with the measurement in force being in kilograms and the arrow indicating the sex-adjusted mean force for that particular patient. And without comment, let me just run through some of these. This is right shoulder flexion and left shoulder flexion over 2,200 days in one patient. Here's another patient, right grip and left grip. Let me point out the symmetry in some of these fluctuations. Here is still another patient over a period of 2,200 days, hip extensor on right and hip extensor on left. And here is that same patient with dorsiflexor, foot dorsiflexor on left, foot dorsiflexor on right, and I think that's hip flexion on left up above. Now, in going over these various plots, and anyone interested in seeing them, I do have more complete plots for each muscle group in each patient. We were struck, here are a couple more plots in still another patient. We were struck by the fact that we could not define any specific trend, regardless of whether the patient was complaining of progressive muscle loss or not, that there was considerable variance, and we think way outside the measurement error for the procedure of maximum voluntary isometric force contraction over long periods of time. The interesting thing seemed to be that there was a tendency for the fluctuations to go in the same direction. That is, if one muscle got better or weak at one point or time, the muscle on the other side of the body did, and in fact, muscles at a distance from that seem to move in the same direction. Now, what that means, I don't know, except that it suggests that maybe there is a systemic, metabolic, immunologic or what have you process that fluctuates with time that produces these fluctuations in patient performance. And that's all I wanted to say about that aspect. I'll leave it there, and maybe later on in our sessions we can talk a bit more about that. Let me go on to the elder statesman kind of thing I'm supposed to do. This morning, as the opening session of a conference such as this often is, set the tone for what probably will be the major discussions in the next few days. I think it's quite clear that we need a definition of what we're dealing with, and until we can define the critter we're talking about, we're going to be in trouble. Now, it's interesting, if one looks at the criteria of Dr. Halstead and the Mayo Clinic criteria and the criteria published by Dr. DeLacus in the New England Journal of Medicine, there is, in fact, a very good agreement as to what might be a functioning definition of post-polio syndrome. Number one is that the original event must be established as truly being poliomyelitis. Number two is that there should be a period of significant improvement and then a period of stabilization, which might be 10 or 15 years. We can certainly work out the numbers, but there has to be a period of time where the process seems to stabilize. And then lastly, that there must be new symptoms not attributable to other causes. Now, that's going to get a little sticky because I, as a neurologist, would like to limit those new symptoms to the neuromuscular apparatus. In other words, if we agree that polio is a disease of a viral attack on the alpha motor neuron, then it seems to me logical that the post-polio syndrome should be new symptoms attributable to trouble with the alpha motor neuron, not with joints and not with scoliosis. Those are important, but they are in a secondary way affecting what we're talking about, so that I might suggest even that we ought not to include pain or maybe even cold intolerance as part of our definition, but that can be debated. It may be that we ought to do something like defining major and minor criteria for the diagnosis and insist on a certain number of each. Secondly, I think we have a major problem of quantitation. If we're going to look at this disease in a scientific way, we simply need numbers. We have to put numbers on the clinical phenomena that we're talking about because, in my view, without numbers, we really cannot apply proper statistical understandings to what we're dealing with. And certainly in no way can we evaluate a therapeutic intervention, which we'll be talking about, I'm sure, in the coming days, unless we're able to apply numbers with standard deviations and to use these in a meaningful way for statistical analysis. I think in this regard, let me say my own bias is that the manual muscle test and other functional rating scales are not appropriate for understanding the natural history of a disease or understanding the effects of a therapeutic intervention. They don't do the job. There are too many inherent problems statistically and with reliability and so on. One cannot help be impressed with the work at the Mayo Clinic, the fact that there is a cohort there that is quite unique with a system of evaluating these patients that may not be available anywhere else in the world, conceivably. On the other hand, as I mentioned in a comment this morning, I think one has to be careful about statistics and correlations. Remember that correlations do not mean cause and effect. Also remember that the more one looks at correlations and statistical significance, the more items you look at, the higher the probability will be of finding something that's statistically significant. So if you look at 20 items, by chance, one or two of those are going to come out statistically significant. That means, and I think in the Mayo Clinic study, what one has to do is go through a data reduction process where you actually reduce the number of variables to a smaller number, as my time is being reduced by Dr. Halstead. Lastly, Dr. Perry brought up the very important question about, is exercise making patients worse, or is it making them better? And again, I'll hearken back to the fact that before we can answer that question, we need two things. We need to define the disease clearly, and we need to be able to quantitate the phenomena we're talking about. So at this point, I'll stop and thank you.
Dr. Munsa, you performed that role of the elder statesman, even though you're not there yet, very admirably. Thank you. I'd like to ask, call on Dr. Bielek to make an announcement of general interest to you, and then just make some announcements about the arrangements for lunch. Dr. Bielek?
Yes, good morning. I work at the Centers for Disease Control, and I'm responsible for the surveillance of new polio, which thankfully in the United States and in many other countries is now an extremely rare event. However, from time to time, I get calls relating to post-polio, and I wanted to share a couple of recent calls that I received with you all and encourage you to talk to me during the course of this symposium to give me your ideas on how I or we should respond to this question. It's a question about precisely what Dr. Munsat just dealt with, the question of quantification of post-polio sufferers. Easter Seals Society have approached the National Center for Health Statistics to include a number of questions, a small number of questions, presumably, in their National Health Interview Survey, which, for those that are not aware of it, is an ongoing national random digit dialing telephone survey, which goes on in the United States all the time, and which covers, I believe, 30,000 people per year. I'm not sure of that number, because of presumably there's some multiplication factor of the number of households that they call times the average household size here in the States. The objective that Easter Seals have expressed is that they want to, A, quantify the number of polio survivors in the United States today, and B, of those survivors, quantify how many answer yes to some questions relating to post-polio syndrome. I should say that the lady that I've dealt with on the telephone does not have a clinical background. She has a statistics background. And it's been difficult for me to explain in very clear terms the problems that we've discussed here this morning, the problem of a case definition. Well, let's go back. The problem of defining who is a polio survivor by self-report on the telephone is a major problem. And secondly, of those who know they are survivors, by self-report on the telephone, who can clearly state, I mean, who could come up with some questions that would clearly specify those who are suffering late effects? Questions that are sensitive and specific. I don't know how to do that, and I want to call upon you all to assist me with that problem, and then in turn to assist the National Center for Health Statistics. Thank you.
As I understand it, we're a little bit behind for lunch, but bear with me as I try to sort out the arrangements. There will be a bus leaving really just about now at 12 noon, so it's about 5 or 7 minutes.
This is the end of take 2 and concludes this portion of the program.